Hello, we welcome you back to Private Market Talks. I'm your host, Peter Antoshek. Today, I am speaking with Tim Flynn, co-founder and CEO of Hayfin Capital. I'm excited to speak with Tim because he's always been a forward thinker. He was an early mover in private credit, starting Hayfin in 2009 following the GFC. Hayfin has since grown to be a leading UK-based alternative asset manager with over 30 billion euro in assets under management. It invests across various strategies, including direct lending, where it recently closed in excess of 6 billion euro in its Fund 4, special opportunities, tactical solutions, high-yield credit, and private equity solutions. Today, it has over 200 industry professionals worldwide. Since its inception, it has invested over 35 billion euro of capital across more than 470 portfolio companies. And it's not done growing. Recently, it opened its newest office in Dubai to add to its 12 other locations, including those in the United States, Paris, Frankfurt, and its headquarters in London. During my conversation with Tim, we cover a wide range of topics. Tim describes Hayfin's investment strategy and the principles that guide those investments. We then discuss the challenges faced by the broader ecosystem of private credit, and Tim shares his views of the future of private credit as an asset class. In this context, he also describes how Hayfin is positioning itself for the future. Finally, we wrap up with a few insights from Tim on what it takes to succeed as a professional in the private markets. As always, you can get a full transcript of this episode and other helpful information at privatemarkettalks.com. And now, my conversation with Tim Flynn, co-founder and CEO of Hayfin Capital. Welcome, Tim, to Private Market Talks.
Thank you, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we get to Hayfin, we were talking before we started recording. I learned that you were a lawyer by background. And I'm kind of curious what your path was to getting a law degree.
Well, that's a bit of a story there. I guess I'll start. I grew up a long way from Wall Street. Geographically, culturally, economically, at one point thought a banker was the nice guy that supervised the tellers at the local branch. And I actually started my career as a beekeeper, of all things.
Okay.
I was found myself graduating university with a lot of student debt, a lot of graduates. I wasn't sure what to do next. I knew I had to start repaying my student loans. I found out that one worked for certain charities around the world. You could defer your student debt. Found a charity in Canada called Care Canada that ran a beekeeping project in Nicaragua that was designed to help the people deal with the Africanized bees that had taken over the country. And they were advertising for a bilingual Spanish-English speaker who was graduating from university. And so I took the job. I thought it was going to be an office job. Nice cushy office job. And when I arrived, I found out that it was anything but. I found myself in the fields, 100 degree weather, temperature, 100% humidity, big boiler suits, lugging lots of equipment around, getting stung dozens of times a day.
You didn't see that as a future career?
Well, listen, that's what took me to law school is the answer. Yeah. About a year on, I said to myself, I need an office job. And got myself from Nicaragua into law school, which is where I started my professional career, shall we say.
You ended up going into becoming an investment professional at
That's
some
right.
point.
Well, look, when I found out about the world of financial services when I was at university, actually, and I applied to all kinds of banking programs, certainly didn't get an interview. I'm not even sure I got responses from my letters. But one of my thoughts of going to law school was using that training and try to figure out a way from practicing law into financial services. And that's what that happened. I worked at a great firm called Sullivan & Cromwell for a little over a year. I did a deal with Goldman Sachs. And immediately after the deal closed, I begged the vice president for a job doing anything. Just give me a chance. And thank God they said yes. So I was off to the races.
And then you ultimately became a partner there, if I'm
that's
correct,
right? Yeah, that's right. So I spent a little over a decade at Goldman. I started in the mergers department, and then I found myself staffed a little bit into the role on what I think was, from memory, Goldman's first high yield bond deal in Europe. And literally no one else at the bank at the time wanted to work on it. They viewed it as commercial banking, you know, beneath their IPO and M&A practice. But I immediately fell in love. I remember the business was, you know, I had been working on countless pitch books, the number 10 person in the team, writing materials that no one seemed to read or care about. Mm. And I found myself staffed on this deal that was a tiny, grubby little business. It sold cigarettes in nightclubs and operated a chain of, you know, small little convenience shops that primarily sold tobacco, lottery tickets, and alcohol. I think it had like 10, 15 million of EBITDA. But it was super real to me in a way that the big deals weren't. It was a real business, real cash flows. I loved that it required me to be a jack of all trades. I think I was literally the only person. I was the banker, salesman, trader, syndicator, risk manager, roadshow coordinator, relationship manager, and I immediately fell in love. And as soon as it closed, I asked if I could move to fixed income and, you know, be part of this, you know, of this new trend in the 90s in Europe and certainly for Goldman of leverage finance.
And then how long did you do that for?
I stayed there for, I think it was about a decade, and it suited me to a T, a bunch of different levels. One, the legal training, and even today, well, I'm sure we'll get into it, is such a valuable base, you know, in this business. Secondly, it was very entrepreneurial. The business didn't exist. And I really enjoyed the creativity, you know, and the thoughtfulness and the lack of playbooks and rule books, you know, to help, you know, design the business. And obviously I never anticipated, and, you know, feel very fortunate with, you know, the tailwind of growth of the leveraged finance markets even in those years. And then again, when I left to start Hayfin, you know, on a thesis and an idea, you know, obviously, you know, the tailwind of growth in what we now call private credit, you know, has been far beyond, you know, certainly my wildest imagination.
So I'm curious, take me back to that time in 2009 when you started thinking about an alternative to doing LevFin at Goldman. What was the investment thesis?
Well, let's go back. And if you, let me paint the picture the following way. If you think about these markets before 2008, there really was no institutional non-investment grade market. You had a small, very small high yield market. You had a tiny syndicated loan market that was really just syndicating into CLOs, and that was it. Everything else was driven by banks, from vanilla credit, you know, through distressed, you know, driven by banks held on balance sheet. And I think it was in 2007, I was aware that Basel II would be adopted Jan 1, 2008. It's pretty simple math. When you look at risk weighting and think about bank ROE, trying to understand where, you know, middle market loans or non-investment grade loans would have to reprice to make the math work for banks. Began to think, you know, perhaps at that spread, it would attract institutions. Spent a lot of time looking at the US. It wasn't the scale of private credit firms there are today. There were a few, but you had the big non-bank lenders, GE Capital, you know, for example. And I began to think that, plus what I started to see in the CMBS market, in the AAA spreads blowing out. It was a very simple idea, really, that the combination of those two factors could create a window to build what we hoped would be the homegrown European market champion in what we now call private credit. But I thought about it as leveraged finance, and I thought about it developing into an institutional business rather than a bank-dominated business. That was the thesis. In hindsight, when I think about the risks that we took and how lucky we've been, you know, to be successful, I certainly underestimated the risks. I certainly overestimated my skills as a CEO and business builder. But what we got right is this tailwind created by that combination of factors. And of course, the crisis happened while I was on garden leave, which made capital formation certainly harder. But what a great entry point in terms of building track record, you know, to give us the credibility, you know, to flesh out the product suite, you know, and really build our business.
At the time when you founded it, what types of deals, investments did you focus on?
Well, look, we started at the pointy end of credit, and, you know, stress and distressed. And the way that we thought about the product suite is, well, imagine a private equity firm. What are all the financing needs? Bank debt. You know, middle market could be in a, you know, a direct lending fund, or larger cap, you know, in a high yield and syndicated loans, you know, business, all forms of junior debt, preferred, convertible preferred, and actually into minority equity through GP led secondary transactions. That's how we thought about the product suite. And we also thought about the product suite as one that needed to be equally fluent in financing growth and financing stress and distress. And we started, as I said, in the pointy end of credit. I think it was not until 2011 or 2012, we made our first direct lending loan. We started our high yield syndicated loan CLO platform a few years after that. And I think it was 7-8 years ago, we started the private equity solutions business.
When you think about investments and you're trying to decide between investments today, mm-hmm. whether to make one or not make one, what key principles guide your investment decisions?
I would identify two. Let me start with the investment strategies themselves. And I think one of the key insights that we had when we were starting to put the business together. In Europe, we use the same words that you use in the US to describe these products and businesses, but the market is fundamentally different. And the key difference is that it's very, very shallow and inefficient, all of these markets, these niches, compared to the US. So what I've learned when I was at Goldman, if you respect the inefficiency of the market, then it's an easier place to make net return in a portfolio compared to the US. It's also an easier place, if you don't respect the inefficiencies, to make a worse net return. Mm-hmm. The insight that we had is that we have to run extremely broad mandates compared to what we would do in the US. We have to think about each of our funds and our fund complexes as a risk return equation. So take direct lending, for example. You know, if we were in the US, we might run a very focused cash flow only, sponsor only business. In Europe, we don't really have that luxury, in my opinion, because markets can go in and out of favor very, very quickly compared to the US. And the other one is a true north that I think has served us really well is understanding we're in a commodity business. It's just money. We can add a bit of value around origination. We can add a bit of value around underwriting, add more value around, you know, successfully managing bankruptcies or restructurings, or adding value in portfolio companies in terms of helping improve operations. But it's a commodity business. It's just money. And if you think about any commodity business, first of all, they're cyclical. Let's not forget that. We can be lulled into thinking they're not. These are cyclical businesses. And like any commodity, one has to be very alive to supply and demand. And the attachment point, where are you attaching? And it's not driven by our fancy suits or fancy educations. It's really driven just by technical factors. And one of the things in Europe that's really different to the US is small changes in absolute terms of supply of credit versus demand for credit. Small changes in absolute terms lead to very big changes in risk return in Europe compared to the US, which is more like an aircraft carrier. So one of the most important things that we try to do with these broad mandates, and we can't predict the future, we're not perfect stock pickers, but it's fairly easy to observe, particularly if you're running a broad mandate, supply, demand, and entry points. So we try to be very alive, very thoughtful around the technicals, our entry point, setting deployment targets for a quarter, developing a shopping list in terms of which areas in our broad mandates are in our favor, what's against us. Let's focus on the parts of our mandate where technicals are more in our favor and benefit from a better entry point in terms of risk return.
I'm curious, given how dynamic and volatile that environment is, how internally do you manage that? How do you assess those on a week-to-week, month-to-month, quarter-to-quarter basis?
Right. Well, the first thing is if you're narrowly focused, it's very hard to observe changes in risk return. You can always justify the next deal with reference to the deal you just did. When you're running a strategy, you're looking at not just different geographies, but we're looking at risk return. You can observe risk return for financing real estate or shipping or some of the healthcare pharma businesses or other asset-backed businesses. It's much easier to compare to be able to understand when one of your areas is poorly priced because of technicals, because it's by reference to something we're doing in another part of the business. So we start with an advantage of having lots of data points coming in that helps us understand relative risk return. And the way that we actually manage it is, you know, before we start, you know, take our most commoditized business, which is our direct lending business in the private credit group, we start each quarter with a deployment target. We understand what our neutral rate of deployment is for whatever fund complex. And we set a deployment target for the quarter with reference to that. So if we set a really low deployment target, because we think the market's generally pretty expensive, it's a pretty small window to get through, gotta be really selective. But the concept is we can't time markets, it's best available. So within that deployment target, select the best risk return we can, and we'll set a shopping list in terms of which areas of our mandate are in focus, the risk return metrics. So for example, blended leverage, spread, OID, attitude towards covenants, structures, et cetera. And then we originate according as best we can to that shopping list.
Got it. And so when you look out at the market today, where do you see the opportunities?
Let's look at last year for a second. Like, again, let's focus on the direct lending business, which is, I think, the easiest place to make the point. Last year was a classic European year. If we think about 2022 in general, where we operated with very modest deployment targets and a very limited risk appetite, had a relatively slow deployment year as a result. As we moved into Q1 2023, the technicals shifted about as rapidly as I've seen in the market in a long time in favor of the lender, largely driven by, you know, demand for credit was low given the M&A volumes. There's a lot of refinancings. We had the Scandi banks largely step out for a period of time, which sucked a lot of supply, you know, into that market. And we saw some of the most attractive risk return we've seen in the most vanilla part of our direct lending mandate, tier one sponsors, cash flow loans. And we set a deployment target that was relatively ambitious, you know, for the first quarter. And we had an exclusive focus on the sponsor business, cash flow business, upper mid market. Let's go to Q4, where the technical shifted the other way. Again, about as rapidly as I've seen, where the supply demand technical, you know, meant that in terms of risk and documentation and return became much more of a borrower's market. Again, our LPs would see a much lower deployment target, much less deployment, and hopefully still reasonable, you know, but much, much less attractive than it would have been in Q1. As we move into 23 and sitting here in this quarter, it's still a relatively tight lending market, you know, in the cash flow side of the business. And there's an increasing focus in parts of our non-sponsor business, parts of our asset financing business, and into, you know, maybe private equity firms that could be perceived, you know, as tier one or, you know, tier two or tier three private equity firms.
So you spend a lot of time now traveling and speaking with investors and fellow GPs. I'm curious as to what those conversations are like in the broader ecosystem of private credit.
The immediate answer, I think about the LP community, there is a far more focused mindset on workout capability, on trying to understand where are we in the cycle, and, you know, does my manager have adequate workout capability. I would say that that is, you know, the number one theme in the LP community. At our investor day, actually, we took a poll. Can't remember the big list of possible factors, but workout capability was certainly far and away the winner. And I think that is an appropriate focus, actually, our view is that we are in a good old-fashioned corporate earnings-driven recession in Europe. I don't care what the public markets are saying. You can see it in the figures. And you know, I remember 15 months ago or so at our 2022 annual investor day in Q3, we encouraged our investors, you know, to begin preparing like we were preparing for what could be a moderate to severe recession and a consequent spike in defaults. So if you cast your mind back 15 months ago and kind of think about the world, we had just come off an incredible level of stimulus on the back of COVID, not just from the central banks, but think about the extraordinary level of fiscal stimulus to plug the hole created by the COVID lockdowns. That was obviously not just beginning to unwind, starting to reverse, and it's continued to reverse in a pretty dramatic way. And of course, in Europe, we had an inflationary shock on the back of Ukraine that hit us much more directly than it would have in the US. And so as we were thinking about all of that in Q3 of 2022, and even though we didn't have a crystal ball, it made sense to us that it would be wise to prepare for what could be a period of elevated defaults. And as we moved through 2023, what we began to observe in the figures, in our portfolios, and you know, other situations where we had data, particularly price volume data, we began to see in Q1 23 some of the impact hit earnings from inflation. Think about a healthcare services business, for example, in the UK, trying to recruit staff, professional staff, some very big wage increases, or think about businesses with vastly different energy costs and limited ability to pass them through. So we began to see that in Q1 23 in terms of margin pressure. And as we moved into Q2 and even more so in Q3, we began to see something quite different, which is just old-fashioned slowdown starting to hit the top line of a lot of businesses. And what we began to see, we knew prior to that from businesses where we had commercially sensitive information around price volume. And we could see already before that, price volume starting to, both price and volume going the wrong way. And all that began to hit the numbers in Q3 of 2023. If you're a German business, for example, selling into any kind of CapEx decision, or a French business, you know, there's been some very, very soft top line as we move. You know, looking forward, we don't have a crystal ball. We've observed our watch list go from a cyclical low 12 months ago, Q4 2022, to something that is more in line with what we would expect. And where we go from here, I think, is hard to really judge. You know, what's the depth and magnitude of the slowdown? There's a big rate bet on in the market. Maybe that plays out. Maybe it doesn't. But there's certainly a lot of pressure in front of us as we move through 2024.
Certainly, at least in the US, the default rate numbers, as reported by S&P and frankly by our own index, still very modest in historical terms. What would you say the default rate is in Europe? And does the default rate reflect what you're describing as stress in the portfolio?
I can't speak to the market, just don't have the data points. And obviously I can look at the indices or what public markets are telling us. You got to keep in mind, you know, that these kinds of moves, let's just take the rate move, takes a long time to cycle through earnings. It takes a long time for earnings to cycle through to covenants and ultimately result in default. And I think it's fairly easy, you know, to go back and look at historical periods and think about a 24, 36 month period is just one thing. But you know, these things take time. Just go back and think about, you know, after the financial crisis with rates going to zero, how long did that take to really cycle through to valuations and into earnings? It takes time. So I don't think it should surprise, you know, anyone that when it's unwinding the other way, it takes time. You've been around a long time as well. You know, these kind of old-fashioned corporate earnings-driven recessions, it's a longer period of time than on some sort of, you know, financial shock. So, no, we have not seen a default spike. We have seen an uptick on our watch list, which if you like is the waiting room.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and how all this plays out, I think is, you know, a very dangerous thing to predict with any certainty. I don't know. We don't know. What I can tell you is that, as you would expect, we're hyper prepared for this. And not just to manage defaults, but, you know, one of the counterintuitive things for a lot of people is actually it's in these moments where the technicals are most in the vanilla lender's favor. So any good manager, and there are a lot of good managers in the market, will be doing the same thing I suspect that we're doing, which is, you know, making sure we're adequately resourced and over-prepared for a spike in defaults. It takes a lot of time, but also really prepared and over-invested to be on the front foot in terms of origination. Because if that is the environment, I suspect if history holds, you know, this will prove to be a fairly extraordinary vintage, even for vanilla lending.
So private credit as an asset class has exploded over the last 20 years. Some have described it as today, as the golden age of private credit. From your perspective, what are your thoughts on the future of private credit as an asset class?
Well, let's break it down. My thoughts on the future of non-investment grade lending as an asset class are very bullish, right? This is a financing tool, you know, that's been around now for a very long time. And it's, I think, deeply embedded, certainly in terms of how most Western countries operate and trade and finance themselves. So my thoughts on non-investment grade lending, the non-investment grade product suite, there's no reason to be anything other than fairly bullish in terms of how the market evolves. By private credit, I think you're referring to this phenomenon that we've had, where so much of this lending, you know, is done in institutional hands, intermediated by firms like Hayfin, as opposed to bank balance sheets. And I think you're probably making a distinction between the traded credit markets, but it's all the same thing.
Yeah.
And there are, you know, it's I guess it's nuanced. Hayfin and all the European managers have been the beneficiary of a regulatory tailwind. It's the whole basis on which we set up the firm. We have a regulatory overlay that has the effect of driving aspects of the leveraged finance business out of bank balance sheets and into institutional hands. And there's certainly no sign of that abating at the moment. In fact, that could make the case, you know, on the back of Silicon Valley Bank and Credit Suisse and some other things, a risk of a reversal is lower than it was prior to that. Europe, you know, has an even more interesting growth position compared to the US. When you think about the differences in the two markets, maybe private credit as a concept didn't exist in a significant way before the financial crisis, but we had all the non-bank lenders, and that's in fact who we really thought about when we started Hayfin, the GE Capitals and Heller Financials, mm-hmm. you know, of the world. And so the market had begun to institutionalize, I think really not long after the savings and loan crisis, us old guys. And Europe started 15 years later, you know, really 2008, 2009. And, you know, if you look at the risk assets that continue to be on bank balance sheets rather than institutional hands, and if you look at, you know, how the market has developed over the past 15 years, it can be faster or slower in certain geographies or certain periods of time, but there's a very pronounced trend that generally, and at a high level, you know, we would expect to continue, and it provides a higher growth rate in Europe than the US as the European economies catch up, you know, to the kind of funding model that exists in the US. So all of that is very positive. I say it's nuanced because my experience as an investor and as a business person is that when there are very, very big growth tailwinds, you know, something for the industry to be thoughtful about, corners can be cut, things can grow more fastly on the front end than they should, given, you know, the middle and back end of these businesses. So I think there are some good reasons to be cautious. You know, I also think one thing to be mindful of, certainly we try to be mindful of, let's imagine a big default cycle, being thoughtful around political risk. And there's a lot of talk in the papers from time to time about shadow banking, and, you know, the systemic risks that are in the industry and mark to market and all the rest of it. I think obviously the systemic risks on the private credit side, you know, compared to a bank balance sheet, are certainly different in terms of the funding models and maturity mismatches, you know, and the rest. But what I would say, you know, in an environment with a big default rate where investors are losing money, where asset owners might be facing foreclosure, my experience as a human in this world is a lot of political pressure comes on the back of that. A lot of scrutiny and bad press can come on the back of that. And my experience is also, when you have very fast growth rates, I think the vast majority, certainly all the firms, fellow GPs that I know, are highly, highly professional, very well run. But when the tide goes out, you know, it's not uncommon to see incidences of bad behavior or corners cut. So my outlook, you know, over the long term, because I back the asset class, I back most managers' ability to recover principal in a default cycle, so long as they have an adequate workout capability. So over the medium long term, my view remains very bullish. But I certainly think it's worth thinking about and being thoughtful around some of the political risks and, you know, some of the scenarios that we could face as an industry as we move through the next few years.
So as you think about the next 5 or 10 years, how do you think about the future of HeyFin in that environment?
Well, one of the things I love about financial services, okay, is probably a frustrated creative, is just how creative it is or can be. Markets are so dynamic and the world is so complex and ever changing. And thirdly, markets are generally pretty efficient at competing over time, excess risk return out. So the one thing I know for sure is the business that we have today compared to the business that we might have in 10 years time is likely to be very different. One of the core values or attributes of the HeyFin group of professionals is a dedication to trying to be very thoughtful students of markets, understanding how we might have made excess return or adequate return yesterday, but trying to look to tomorrow and opportunities and segments and, you know, how conditions evolve to build the business and the product suite that fits a portfolio need based on the market of tomorrow. So I can't tell you because I don't know. What I can tell you is what I love about this job in this business is exactly that phenomenon. You know, our business today and our business tomorrow is going to be different. And how fun is it, you know, to be part of that and try to use our brains and our intuition and our analysis, you know, to try to adapt as conditions adapt.
Well, listen, this has been a great conversation. I appreciate it. I just have a couple of final questions. When you look at hiring a young professional, what do you look for in that person, that individual, when you're hiring?
I'll answer the question in two ways. First of all, persistence is an undervalued but incredibly important trait, I think, in any professional services firm. And one of the things, you know, that is really important to us when we're looking at hiring young people is evidence of persistence. There's a core value within HeyFin that I mentioned around adaptability and trying to be athletic. If we look at almost all of our investment professionals, because our mandates are broad and our focus moves, the more athletic they are, the more different types of things they can do. A vanilla loan today, managing a complicated restructuring tomorrow is very important. Ours is a culture, a no superstar culture, where we value the midfield general who makes everyone else 10% better over the superstar striker. So for a person to thrive at HeyFin, they genuinely need to be low ego and put the team and clients and firm ahead of themselves and operate with humility. The second way I'd come at an answer to the question, it's back to this world being complex and dynamic. And if you think about one of the core functions of any investment professional is to predict the future trajectory of earnings. And earnings are driven by a very diverse, complicated geography or world. And one of the things that I feel like we've learned over time is the more our team resembles the world around us, the better investment decisions we make. From a nationality perspective, in Europe, it's pretty easy. You know, there's some French businesses that are very difficult to understand from an American or English perspective. Not because diversity, you know, diversity can be a core value, is an important value, but actually, as an investment firm, it's essential. And I remember learning that very early in my career at Goldman, when the French team brought a business forward, a business that made frozen food or frozen dinners, prepackaged frozen dinners, and that was sold at enormous prices and enormous gross margins. And I remember thinking about TV dinners as a kid that you buy for nothing and eat in front of the TV. And I just thought, this is the stupidest business model I think I've ever seen. And I remember being completely blown away to realize that actually, no, in the French market, you know, that was an absolutely fantastic business. And that's when I said to myself, pay some French people right. on our team.
So I know you're an avid listener to podcasts.
Yes.
What is a guilty pleasure podcast that you enjoy?
I am really enjoying Mark Maron's WTF podcast. Mark Maron, I think he's one of the first guys in the business. What I love about his podcast is he can engage with all kinds of different people, stand-up comic, all people from very different backgrounds, and get them to talk about things. They might be there to promote a book.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember listening to his podcast with Barack Obama years ago and got Obama to talk about aspects of his childhood and growing up and in his life that I'd never heard before. And that is, I'm on a long flight to Tokyo tomorrow. This morning before I came here, I already preloaded a bunch of Mark Maron WTF podcasts to keep me company on the flight.
Tim, thank you so much for being on Private Market Talks. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Peter. I've enjoyed our conversation, and thank you for having me.